and welcome. You're tuned in to the best in true crime talk radio. This is True Crime Tuesday. I'm your host, Dave Schrader. Along with me, as always, Tim Dennis. Hello, Tim.
Hey there.
The Flat Tire Murders. Unsolved crimes of a South Florida serial killer. That's our topic in just a few moments. Michael Burns, our guest. We do have Dumb Crime, Stupid Criminals. So if you are a Stitcher Premium subscriber, you'll get to hear that right after the interview. If you are just one of the regular Stitcher subscribers, you'll get to hear the interview in its entirety. But in order to hear the entire show, you have to be a Stitcher Premium member. That's $5 a month, gets you access to all of the archives. You get all of Darkness Radio, all of True Crime Tuesday, commercial free, and you get every other show that's part of the Stitcher Premium package. Hundreds of thousands of hours of programming in every type of genre you could possibly want. So it's a great value for that $5 a month. All right, let's get into it, shall we? This is interesting. Tim, Florida, we've been picking on Florida for years with our Dumb Crime, Stupid Criminals, but maybe for a good reason. Although we'll find out today from an actual Florida man what his thoughts are on all of this. Michael Burns is our guest today. He is a native of Miami, Florida, left to attend law school in California, and he's practiced law in California since 2005, currently living in San Jose. And he has had an interest in true crime and unsolved mysteries for decades, and he's now written his first book, The Flat Tire Murders, Unsolved Crimes of a South Florida Serial Killer, published this year by McFarlane & Company. He is here to talk to us about this very strange case from South Florida between 1975 and 1976. Let's jump right into this and touch base on this type of case. First of all, Michael, you've been a Florida man. Why is it that it seems that all of the goofiest, silliest, weirdest crimes come out of your state? Do you have any clue why that is?
Good afternoon. Thank you for having me. I think part of it has to do with and I only found this out a couple years ago, with the legal structure in Florida allowing for greater disclosure of public documents, police reports, things like that under the Sunshine Law. So I think there's possibly that element that the media can just get more information out of Florida. But I think another aspect is it's such a strange state in the sense that the northern part of the state is a really part of the deep South. And then you have central Florida and then South Florida with a huge transient. And I mean that not in the homeless sense, but people coming in and out, people that want to move down there for the weather, maybe move down there during the winter, the snowbirds. So you have a lot of influx and outflux of people there. So it kind of creates the perfect situation for some odd crimes, odd behavior, and very interesting stories.
Yeah, that's to say the least. I mean, we're certainly entertained by the high level of strangeness and the innovation behind a lot of the weird crimes that Florida man and woman seem to come up with on their own. But my God, it's just week after week. I ask for people to send us stories of their zany crimes from their hometowns. And, I might get one here or there, but every week we comb Dumb Crime, Stupid Criminals, 90% of those stories pour forth from the great state of Florida. Although, thinking about it, it's probably not fair, Michael, because Florida is such a catch-all, right? People retire there and move there from all around the world. So it's really probably not many true Florida men or women that are committing this. They just happen to be people who are living there.
Right. And like I said before, the northern part of the state is very southern, very I call it South Alabama to certain people. And then you have the southern part of the state where people, come from all over the world. People go down there because there's no state income tax. There are snowbirds that move down there just for the weather. And so, yeah, you have a influx of people, and it just really it really creates a lot of opportunity for these kind of bizarre people to come forth. But yeah, I do have a great deal of respect for the state and the people there. Of course, I grew up there. But yeah, it's an entertaining place.
I know we've done shows regarding killers, and Willis Morgan, who came on the show, who firmly believes that young Adam Walsh was murdered by Jeffrey Dahmer, of all people.
Right.
He was the first to inform us. Jeffrey Dahmer, Otis Toole, and oh God, the third guy's name is totally escaping me. Henry Lee Lucas,
mm-hmm.
were all active killers in the state at the same time. Are there a lot of serial killings that take place in Florida besides Dexter that we don't know about?
Well, I mean, you go back to one of the most famous female serial killers, Eileen Wuornos, was active in Florida in the late 80s. And she certainly embodied that transient sort of hitchhiking prostitute Florida woman, I guess you could say. And she was active. And yes, there certainly were serial killers. I've listened to Mr. Morgan on several occasions and his story about Jeffrey Dahmer, who did live in South Florida. He lived in Miami Beach for about a year or two in the early 1980s is fascinating. It just goes to show Dahmer got out of the army, was discharged, and moved from Germany. And they said, where do you want to go? What, we'll give you a ticket to go anywhere in the country. He said, send me to Miami. So, because he knew that it was a warm place and you can just kind of pick up on the beach there and start a new life. And yeah, it's the perfect place for people to come to. I mean, look at Ted Bundy. When he escaped from Colorado in 1977, he moved right down through the United States and ended up in Florida, and that was his destination. So it's a destination for some very odd people.
Very strange. By the way, folks, I'm just going to mention this, and Tim, I haven't even told you this. Willis Morgan reached back out to me, and he has a very unlikely alliance that is willing to join him. And they're going to be joining us in a few weeks back here on the program to talk about the Adam Walsh case. And it's a real eye opener who he's got coming on to talk about this. Plus some information from the publishing house that printed the book that kind of helped close the case on Adam Walsh. So we'll be talking about all of that in the next few weeks as well. But let's dive into this unsolved crimes of a South Florida serial killer. Now, you mentioned that Bundy was in that area at that time as well. Is there any chance that that Ted Bundy may have been a part of any of these murders?
What's funny about Ted Bundy is his connection to Miami. In 1968, he attended the Republican National Convention, which was held in Miami Beach as a delegate of Nelson Rockefeller. So that was his first trip to Miami in 1968 when he was 22. And of course, in 1978, he committed a series of brutal murders at the Chi Omega sorority house at Florida State University in Tallahassee, which is in the northern part of the state, and the murder of 12-year-old Kimberly Leach in Lake City, again in the northern part of Florida. So he was there in the 60s. He was there in the late 70s. The big question is whether he was there in 1975. Two detectives that I spoke with, both of whom are still alive, that worked on the Flat Tire murders, those two particular cases that are called the Flat Tire murders, still to this day believe that Ted Bundy was the one who was responsible for at least those murders. But you've got some other people, including a Ted Bundy expert that I have a great deal of respect for, that says, no, he was not. He was in Utah at the time of those murders in 1975. I respect both sides, the detectives and the expert that I spoke with. So there's definitely,
well, it would seem that that aspect would be something that would be easily provable, right? I mean, you should be able to track him, even though there wasn't the same kind of internet access that we have today, GPS tracking, so on and so forth. There should be people that could put him in either one of those cities at any one of those times. Or is that the problem, that there are, and he was gumpy? I know he jumped back and forth between places a lot.
Right. He was all over sort of the Western states from Utah to Idaho to Colorado, back and forth in his Volkswagen. I think it's unlikely that he was in Miami in July of 1975, but looking into the dates that he was active in Utah, at least, there is sort of a 4-week gap, basically, that is unaccounted for when he, at least from what we know, stopped murdering. And if there's anything you know about Bundy, it's he was a compulsive, especially towards that time, murderer. So, establishing where exactly he was, for a particular week in 1975 is difficult. Yeah, there's people's recollections of where he might have been. Suspicions, but pinning it down is not exactly as easy as it would be these days.
Well, talk to us about the crimes, if you could. Set us up and let us know what happened.
Sure. The book is titled The Flat Tire Murders, but that's sort of a subset of what happened. In 1975, in Dade and Broward counties, which are the two counties on the southeastern tip of Florida, it's where most of the population in South Florida lives. There was a series of murders beginning in January and ending in basically December of that year. 13 victims, some of them were very young girls, were all found either deceased in canals or very close next to sort of on the banks of canals. These victims were as young as 14 years old. I think the oldest one was 27 years old. Two of the murders involved the killer deflating the tires of the women's vehicles at the mall and presumably offering them a ride to go get the car fixed. Those are the two murders that they believe, at least the two detectives that I spoke with, believe that Ted Bundy probably did, just based on the modus operandi. But these were a series of murders of very young girls, a lot of them teenagers, throughout 1975, which began in January and stopped in December.
That does seem to fit his MO, right? Of always putting himself in the position where he's in need of help or being the person who can come to the aid of someone else and using that vulnerability on either side to make things happen in his favor.
You're absolutely right. And I think back on, anyone familiar with Bundy's modes of operating. In 1974 at Lake Sammamish, he used the arm in the cast, help me with my sailboat ruse. And he abducted murdered two women in one day. In 1975, he attempted to abduct Carol Durant from a mall in Utah using a fake badge and telling Mr. Ranch, your car has been broken into. I'm an undercover officer. I need you to come with me. We're going to make a report. I'm going to take you to the police substation. She eventually asked, hey, can I see a badge? And he flashed what was, a fake officer's badge at her. And he almost abducted and killed her that day. So that was the murder. That was the crime that he was eventually convicted of. He would use both the vulnerability and the position of authority. And I think that those detectives are absolutely right that those two murders definitely fit in with his MO.
How hard is it for you as you're looking back on a case that's that old, nearing 50 years, to uncover new details about these cases and about the murders and possible suspects?
If it weren't for the people that were still alive that investigated these crimes, it would be very difficult to get anything deeper than what's already known. The COVID situation last year kind of put a delay on obtaining records from at least from Dade County, from Broward County. A lot of things, kind of ground to a halt. So. Really getting in touch with the people who were there and who investigated was helpful. And yeah, we're talking 46 years later, and a lot of people have passed away. Most of the victims' parents are deceased at this point. So you're left with sort of reaching out to whoever you can to get information. So it is definitely very difficult, but I think, at least if the public is aware of these murders and that knowing that they're not forgotten, I'm hoping that there will be some memories that are jogged. Somebody might know something that they've kept secret for years. They might think of something. it's certainly better than the situation before, where these murders have just essentially been forgotten.
Now, talk to us about the victims, and what can you inform us about their lives, who they were? I hate to just kind of pass over those aspects and talk about the crime itself and the killer's modus, but modus operandi. But who were these people?
Well, when you look at the victims, they were, a lot of them were just your typical sort of teenage suburban girls. They range from everything from a woman who moved from the first victim, Judith Osterling, who'd moved from Indiana down to Miami and was working at a massage parlor, which was sort of a front for more explicit things. She was only 19 years old. Two of the victims, Barbara Schreiber and Belinda Zetterauer, were 14-year-old high school students, and they were both shot and left next to a canal in Broward County. 14-year-old girls, these were not prostitutes. These were not, runaways or troubled girls. They were basically your typical suburban teenage girls. One was 15 years old. One was 17, the 17-year-old Arietta Shaw. She was married and had a child at the age of 17. They were not troubled girls. They were, like I said, your typical suburban girls in Dayton, Broward County.
What was their day like? I mean, what do you know about what they were doing? What put them in this position to kind of, fill in a little bit of the gaps in information about them?
Sure. These were different. There were different times back in the 70s, and especially in the mid 70s, when hitchhiking was sort of a popular, well accepted way to get around. And a lot of young girls would hitchhike. And looking back on it from today's perspective, we're kind of shocked that, a 14 or a 15-year-old girl would be standing on the side of a road with her thumb out trying to get a ride from a stranger. It shocks us. But back then, this was before Bundy. This was before Gacy. This was before a lot of the crimes that gave us, the warning that there were bad people out there. So a lot of the girls did hitchhike, and they used that as sort of their way to get around. They didn't have cars. Most of them, the two women that were the victims at the mall when their cars were deflated, that was very interesting. That case happened 8 days apart. The first was Ronnie Gorlin. She was 27 years old. Her car had a flat tire at the 163rd Street Mall. She was found in a canal the next day. And then 8 days later, Elise Rapp, who was 21 years old, was abducted in the exact same manner, found in the exact same canal. They were both Jewish. They both had E license plates, which denotes that the cars were leased or rented. So there were some similarities there. And those are the two murders that are known as the flat tire murders. But the rest of the murders were referred to as the canal murders, mostly during 1975, because these bodies were showing up in canals, on a monthly or bi-monthly basis.
That's horrifying. And how many deaths total were there, did you say, that, with the flat tire and canal murders as well?
13 victims in 1975.
And of those victims, there was no DNA left behind, nothing that could be, cold. I mean, we're certainly solving cases now that are 40, 50, 60 years old because somebody thought to keep a soiled piece of underwear or dress or something that they're able to now track the DNA through familiar ties on like Ancestry, 23andMe, and some of these other depositories.
I did get the medical examiner's reports for the murders of Ronnie Gorlin and Elise Rapp. And in one of those cases, the Rapp case, there is reference to biological material being obtained as part of the medical examiner's autopsy. So my suspicion and my inclination is that there is some sort of biological material that's available. how useful it will be for law enforcement to test it and to maybe do what they did with the Golden State Killer, create a familial background and sort of pin in on one person. I don't know exactly, but my suspicion is that there is some DNA available. The other problem, though, is that these bodies, a lot of them were in the water, and the water is pretty damaging for forensic evidence like fingerprints, hair. There was a pubic hair that was found on in one of the flat tire cases. So there's the potential there's some DNA there. But putting bodies in water is unfortunately a good way to sort of get rid of trace evidence and biological material. It's not foolproof, but it does hinder the collection of that evidence. But my suspicion is there is biological evidence that can be tested. And then that goes to how many of the murders are connected. Are they all connected? Were they done by groups of people? I think when you draw some parallels to the Golden State Killer, it wasn't until 2001, I believe, that they connected all the rapes in Sacramento with the murders in Southern California and realized this is the same guy here. In those cases, that was based on the DNA matching. In these cases, we don't know. We only have the patterns and the similarities to go on to determine whether this was the work of one person.
Now, I think that's an important element too, right? I mean, there's a lot of locations throughout the United States where state patrol are in charge, but their job, some of these state troopers, they've got a 200-mile stretch of area to patrol. And it wouldn't take much for serial killers to just drag the body just far enough off the road it can't be seen, right? So if there's a canal, if there's things like that, you know, easy dump sites, that very well may be the work of multiple killers.
That's right. It could be the work of multiple killers. I think, however, when I looked at there are maps in the book that explain the location of the bodies, there's a definite pattern showing up that the canal next to US 27 in Broward County was a frequent dump site. And it's kind of interesting that, you know, well, where else would you put a body in South Florida? You can take it maybe to the Everglades. You can't really bury a body in South Florida because there's so much, it's such a high water table and the coral rock, essentially you can't dig more than, trust me, I tried it as a kid. You can't dig more than a foot down. So you're not really going to bury bodies. So if you need to dispose of something, it's either out in the Everglades or perhaps in a canal or maybe a wooded area. But that that canal next to US 27 just kept coming up over and over again. So either you're correct, it's either the work of several people that have decided this is a good place to put a body, or it's one person realizing, you know, I was able to dump something here before and maybe I'll do it again. The locations are just limited in Florida for disposing of a body, because it's on the one end, it's South Florida is a very urban developed area. Then to the west, there's the Everglades, which is a swamp basically. So there's really, you don't have much in terms of your options there. So I think somebody was desperate enough to just throw the bodies into the canal and hope for the best.
That's so strange to me, right? I mean, you think Florida, and as you said, the Everglades are not far away. You know, those areas and waterways seem to be filled with all kinds of creepy crawlers that would love to eat any evidence you throw their way.
Right. And in the beginning of my book, I provide a discussion of why the canals were built, how extensive they are. There's 2,600 miles of canals all throughout South Florida. And the things that law enforcement and people dread, you know, government dredging in there, that they found in the canals are just, they found cars with people in them that, you know, they thought the people were missing. They found parts of rockets, parts of airplanes and helicopters, the discarded, anything you want to get rid of basically goes in the canals. And out in the Everglades, it's just a beautiful area, but it's very desolate. It's full of all kinds of alligators, crocodiles, birds of prey. So there's definitely lots of places to get rid of bodies. But yeah, the canals end up taking anything that people want to get rid of, including, you know, what killers will dispose of.
Now, with that said, since there is such an interconnectivity of these canals and that they stretch over long areas, is there any chance that these bodies are being dumped somewhere else and this is a catch basin? This is just a location where a lot of them are washing up.
That's a possibility. There is a certain degree of movement in canals. So I think possibly where they're being found is not, you know, the exact spot where they were dumped, but it's the canals are pretty slow moving. And in the book, I do talk about the fact that even if they move, you know, a billion gallons of water, they're only going to drop about an inch. So they're really very, sedentary bodies of water. So they're not the same as a lake or the ocean where there's going to be a lot of movement. I think probably in these cases where the bodies were found is probably close to where they were dumped, just by the nature of the canal and the movement of the water.
Are all of the bodies that were recovered identified?
Yes, they were all identified. And a lot of the bodies were found the next day or very shortly thereafter, which is, I think, interesting in that it possibly shows us that whoever was disposing of these bodies was careful enough to get rid of the bodies, but not too concerned with whether they would be found. I think as long as they weren't found with the bodies, they were okay with that. So the bodies were all identified and all found fairly quickly, with one or two exceptions, but like the two flat tire murders, they were found the next day. So there was it says a lot, I think, in terms of who was disposing the bodies, why they were putting them where they were. I don't think they were too concerned with the bodies being found. So they were all pretty much found very quickly.
Does that say something about the MO of the killer in the sense that he wanted to be found, or he wanted in a braggadocious way to have people acknowledge just how prolific he was? Or
yeah,
perhaps she was.
Yeah, I think that's definitely something to bear in mind, that this person was just immune to any kind of fear about law enforcement, possibly because of the fact that in the 1970s, much like it was 50 years before that, that you usually had to have some sort of eyewitness or hard evidence. There was no DNA evidence. So unless you could really put somebody in close proximity to where a person disappeared and was murdered, you could get away with murder. It's a lot harder now. I also think there's the possibility that this was just the only option that was available. And I'm thinking of Samuel Little, who was the killer who confessed in 2018 to 2020 to, I think, 93 murders. And they asked him, what are the two places you killed the most? He said, Miami and Los Angeles. And when he was talking about his Miami murders, he said he tried once to bury a body and, you know, couldn't get down more than a foot. And he said, I'll never try to dig a grave in South Florida again. If I'm going to dump somebody, I'm just dumping them either on the side of the road or a canal or behind a house or something. I'm not going to try to dig a body. So I think the canals just are places that are available for disposal of a body.
Now, with the methodology of murder as well, is it pretty consistent across the board with the women that they were uncovering?
No. When that's surprising as well, because you would expect a very similar, if you're looking at someone like a Ted Bundy, a very similar manner and signature that they would use for these murders. But in these cases, you've got everything from stabbings to chokings and beating to death, to gunshots. The two young victims, the 14-year-olds, Barbara Schreiber and Darlene Zetterauer, were both shot. So you've got a wide range of methods that this person or people are using to kill these girls. So, and that adds to the confusion of whether this was one person doing this or a group of people, but why were they happening so consistently and being found almost in the same locations? It's one of the mysteries of this case.
Well, let's talk. Obviously, we know that your thoughts are that Ted Bundy is at least behind the flat tire murders. But were there other suspects at that time? And what made them points of interest for law enforcement? I'll leave you with that question. The book, The Flat Tire Murders, Unsolved Crimes of a South Florida Serial Killer. Michael P. Burns, our guest. We have a link up for that book in today's program guide. So let's discuss, Michael, some of the other possible suspects for this, or were there any?
Well, that's a good point. To go back to what you said before about Bundy, I'd like to say I'm open to the idea of Ted Bundy possibly being behind the flat tire murders. I kind of doubt it just based on the fact that he was in Utah, but I don't foreclose entirely that with him anything's possible. So I'm kind of keeping an open mind about it. I wouldn't say I'm endorsing it, but in terms of other suspects, there really were none. And when you go back and you look at some of the media reporting back then, it really reflected that police were just, they had nothing to go on. They would get a few leads that looked good that led to nothing. But they really, and this is also based on my interviews with the three detectives, they worked their butts off. They conducted hundreds of hours of surveillance. They investigated every known sex offender. But they were really working within the confines of what was available at that time, where, you know, you go out and do interviews, there's very limited forensic evidence. And you just try to appeal to the public to see if anybody saw anything or heard anything. But really, they came up with nothing.
So somebody brazenly murders, dumps bodies, and it's not one, it's not two, but multiple, and nobody sees anything.
Right. Well, you know, the two flat tire murders, the women were probably abducted from the 163rd Street Mall, which is your typical suburban shopping center. And their cars had deflated tires. The cars had to be deflated, you know, by the killer. And police went to that mall and they obtained some descriptions. They obtained some composites. They were contradictory. People really didn't have anything of value to offer. And there were never any suspects that were at least publicly identified. It was very strange. Very strange in terms of the lack of good solid leads that led to suspects. And that could be also. Oh, go ahead.
I was going to say, you know, I mean, for the longest time, that you know, they believed that there were specific aspects of, I guess, victims, you know, that like Bundy was attracted to a certain look when it came to the victims. Are there any ties that any of these victims had? Did they look similar? Were they similar in age? Did they know one another? Was there anything like that that might help us make sense of the very high strangeness of all of this?
Sure. The two flat tire murder victims, Elise Rapp and Ronnie Gorlin, were both Jewish, both in their 20s, both had similar looks to them. The other girls, the two 14-year-olds that were shot, Barbara Schreiber and Darlene Zetterauer, were best friends, so they knew each other. The other victims, you know, they were not known to one another. There were no real connections that I can identify. Other than they potentially hitchhiked. I think that was perhaps the most common denominator, especially with the younger girls, was that they could have hitchhiked. They were known to hitchhike. And that may have been exactly what led to their demise.
especially with the fact that you realize that there's a tie to like malls, you know, which again was another one of Bundy's kind of favorite little deals, but also Otis Tool, Henry Lee Lucas, even Jeffrey Dahmer. And if all of these guys are all in that kind of vicinity within that same time, it's pretty terrifying to know that, you know, was one feeding the other. How well publicized were these murders and, you know, the recovery of these bodies?
They were covered, I think, pretty extensively in the local newspapers and in the local media. They never went beyond that. It was never a national story. But what's funny is that, or what's interesting is that as 1975 ended and the murders ended, the public, essentially the spotlight was taken off of those murders. And I also discuss in the book why that probably happened, because in the 1970s, South Florida was undergoing a crime explosion. It was one of the most dangerous places in the country, believe it or not. It was news to me as well. So I think as these murders happened, police tried their hardest to work them and to come up with a solution, but they couldn't work them forever. And after a year, without any leads, without getting any solid suspects, their deaths were piling up with, you know, additional crimes that needed their attention. So these sort of fell into the background, just due to the nature of the violent nature of South Florida in the 1970s. So, they were publicized, but they certainly were forgotten after the mid 1970s.
How terrifying that somebody was that perfect, an apex predator, that it just stacked up on police desks. Do you think there's any chance that if this killer did change their MO or killers, that all they did was shift from one aspect of who they were focusing on to something else? Or have we looked at other parts of Florida after that, when these murders seem to stop and quiet down? Do we find, you know, 40 miles away or 100 miles away in Florida, murders like this start picking up somewhere else?
Well, yeah, I do talk about in the book the other flat tire murders that occurred outside of the South Florida, some of them in Louisiana in the late 1970s. And, you know, some of them actually preceding 1975 in Los Angeles and Santa Barbara, places like that, where the same MO was used. I think definitely there's the possibility that the MO was changed. Not every killer is tied to a particular signature or a particular method of dumping a body. I think Samuel Little, when he was confessing to his 93 murders, I think was quite had a variety of different techniques or approaches to murder, whether it was strangulation or gunshots or stabbings, and not every killer, and I think that's important to note, is like a Ted Bundy, where they have a very particular type or a particular MO. I think some of them are just predators of opportunity, and when you have young girls hitchhiking like you did in the 1970s, that was just the perfect opportunity for somebody to take advantage.
When you step back from the focal point of the story and look at murders, that flat tire murders that preceded and followed up after, can you put any other killer, any well-known killer in those same areas? You know, almost like a tracking or a fingerprint.
You know, I wasn't able to put any other killers in those particular areas because, you know, the timing often did not match up, where somebody like a Bundy may not have been in South Florida at the same time. There may have been some other issues with other serial killers, but I certainly think that there's the possibility that there may be more than one killer involved, that there may be people working either together or just individuals, or it could certainly all just be the work of one person. It really remains to be seen at this point. And part of that is the public awareness of what happened. It really just, I think the cases need to be brought to light, and there needs to be some public discourse on these forgotten victims.
And so people do understand there are beliefs that people like Goddess Tool and Henry Lee Lucas worked together, right? In tandem, they may not have always been with each other, but they were both killing. They both knew of each other. They were friendly. They, you know, had those connections. However, you also have serial killers like Otis Toole that laid claim to hundreds of murders, which they could prove he really had nothing to do with because he wasn't in those areas at that time. So it's got to make it almost a nightmare when you do have a serial killer perspective in mind and realize that, you know, you don't even know how legitimate their claims are.
Right. And I think what the impetus for me writing this book was when 2008, when Joseph DeAngelo was arrested as the Golden State Killer, the fact that crimes from the 1970s, you know, we're talking 40 years later, could be solved. I think the answer has to be in some sort of DNA or advanced forensic science, simply because, like you said, whether we're trying to pinpoint or piece together whether someone was somewhere 45 years ago versus someone like Otis Toole or Henry Lucas lying about where they were just for the attention. I think at the end of the day, there's going to have to be a resolution of the cases through forensic testing. That's not to say that it's not important to have the public give their input. And I think that's very valuable as well. But when you look at the Golden State Killer, it was solved through advanced forensics. So I think that's probably the way this group of cases is going to go.
That's crazy. That's crazy. When you're digging into this and you're looking at these cases, talking to the original police that were involved in investigating these claims, do you see an inept police force that just wasn't prepared for this type of activity? And I don't mean inept as though they were just Barney Fife, you know, but that they just were not capable of these kind of deep examinations, especially for that era.
Well, I think number one, it was before the era of the serial killer. So I think the idea of a predator like a Ted Bundy or John Wayne Gacy, someone who's out there trolling repeatedly with a method to, you know, abduct and murder women, that I don't think that was really in their consciousness. Maybe about 10 years later, that would have been, but not really in 1975. I think the police worked as hard as they could and did the best they could with what they had. I really think it's also like we talked about at the beginning of the interview, is sort of the nature of South Florida, where you have you know, people coming in and out, transient lifestyles. Some people want to be beach bums. Some people are there for the winter and they leave. There's a lot of trucking through the Everglades with sugarcane and things like that. So it's a population that's on the move. And I think police probably did the best they could in that situation. And they just weren't aware, I don't think, of the fact that there may be someone like a serial killer out there. I don't think that was in their consciousness.
Do you see much in the way of ego, that it was just that they refused to re-examine certain aspects of the crime because they don't want to look as though they dropped the ball the first time around?
You know, that's a possibility, but I think they do want to have these cases. Oh, go ahead.
I was going to say, and understand, I'm not trying to put them on trial, right, but we've heard strange stories that, you know, one city to the next, they refused to share information. Everybody right. wanted the collar. Everybody wanted the insight and the intel, but nobody wanted to be the one to share it.
Right. And I think that brings to mind the Zodiac Killer, where it was a multi-jurisdictional case where some people were very protective over their information. There wasn't a lot of sharing. But I also think in those cases and in this case, we've got to take a step back from what may be hearsay, what may be the sort of public, the press or the media view of it. We really don't know what was going on in there in law enforcement in the during the investigation. So I think, to be fair to them, it sounds like they really wanted these cases to be solved. I think just the nature of the victims, I mean, these were teenage girls, you know, some as young as 14 years old. And if that's not enough to motivate you as a law enforcement officer or detective to really get whoever is doing this, you know, what is? These were the ultimate in victims. You know, they were basically children.
But you said you've got two detectives who believe firmly that the flat tire killer was Bundy, even though there's a really good chance that he was in Utah at that time. That, again, should be something that would be easily cross-referenced. You know, Bundy always seemed to be making a name for himself wherever he was. So could that, you know, do you think that once some of these police get fixated on one killer, that's where they stay and refuse to kind of step back and re-examine?
You know, that's possible. But I think also what we're looking at is law enforcement reflecting years later on, well, why didn't we solve that one? What did we miss? What was wrong? And maybe at that point, looking back and saying, yeah, I think it probably was this or that, or this particular suspect or that particular suspect. I don't think ego is really to blame. I just think it's a frustration with having an open case like this. I do think that there's a lot of frustration and probably bitterness that the cases weren't solved. And maybe the explanation of, well, it was someone like Bundy, may give some sort of partial, closure that, well, maybe we can at least think it was him. But I think the law enforcement that currently is hopefully looking at these cold cases, is going to have a fresh set of eyes and look to the forensic evidence rather than, you know, trying to place certain people at certain times 40, 50 years later.
Does it ever cross your mind since the release of this book on September 30th of this year that maybe, just maybe, the killer has read this book himself?
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Yeah. I've thought of that. I've thought a lot of times of, you know, who this person was, what happened to them. Did they move to another state? Did they end up in prison? You know, when you look at somebody like Ted Bundy, they deteriorated so much that by the end of his killings, you know, he was desperately trolling and, college campuses, he was on the run. They don't end up living sort of normal lives. But then you look at someone like Dennis Rader, who was married and who was able to stop and who was able to sort of control himself. So I don't think there's a one cookie cutter serial killer that we can look at. I think they're like you and I. They're different. They're unique in their own particular ways. And they may share some traits, but everybody's different. I really think so.
I wonder, too, if in the cosmic scope of things, do the police in those areas, as time progresses, do they just surrender themselves to the fact of, you know, it was probably Bundy, Henry Lee Lucas, Otis Toole, they're all dead. They're all accounted for. There's really no, you know, there's enough new crime that why bother turning stones over and forget that the victims haven't been spoken for, neither of their families. And, you know, in that summarily dismissive nature of, well, the killer's probably paid the ultimate price by this point, you know, they're forgetting that there's no closure for everybody else involved in the case.
Yeah. I think that at least from the detectives that I spoke with, you know, there was immense frustration that they couldn't solve these cases, that they put in the hard work. And I think maybe looking back 40, 45 years later, you know, they've been retired for so long that they're sort of doing the best they can to come up with an explanation of why these crimes happened, why they weren't solved, and what the best explanation is. I think if we're talking about what's currently being done, perhaps on a cold case basis internally, that we don't know about right now, and that we will only find out just like Joseph DeAngelo, where there's suddenly a press conference that, hey, we've caught this guy, and we don't know what's going on right now. I can only be optimistic and hopeful that these cases have not been forgotten. That's why I wrote the book. I don't want these cases to lie fallow for 40 more years.
It would be great. And listeners, if you have any insights, this real insight, any thoughts, ideas that could help move this along, please reach out to law enforcement. Don't do it speculating. Nobody needs well, and I guess I shouldn't even say that, because sometimes it is the armchair quarterback, right? The home murder she wrote and Columbo's that do sometimes see a different perspective of these cases that might open or crack the case open. But it's unfortunate that in these situations, people reach out with a lot of time wasting thoughts and efforts as well.
Yeah. Yeah. And the reason I wrote the book wasn't to really speculate or to cause people to start the rumor mill. It was really just to say, hey, these cases happened. They were important enough at the time, and they got a lot of publicity at the time. They still haven't been solved. So if you know anything, contact law enforcement, or at least talk about the cases. That's one of the things that helped with the DeAngelo case. At least in 2016, the California Department of Justice said, we're still looking at these cases. We have not given up. If you have any information, contact police. There's a reward available. They kept the cases in the public spotlight 40 years later. So I think the same thing needs to happen here.
Have you heard from anybody reaching out to you since the book's been published with any thoughts, ideas, or even trying to take ownership for it?
No, I haven't. And, the book's only been out for a couple weeks now, but, I'm happy to, on my social media, I'm happy to engage with people. And if they have any questions or thoughts, I'm certainly available to the best of my ability to discuss these cases with people who were there, particularly, people that were in South Florida in the 1970s, whether it's directly related to these cases or not. I think just the culture at the time was very interesting. Like I said before, the hitchhiking, some of these things just I never grew up with, I grew up in Miami and nobody hitchhiked because, you might get picked up by a lunatic, but just 10 years earlier, 5 years earlier, that was a way of life. That was what girls did to get around. And it's just such an interesting, I think, a slice of America at the time, sort of before the Ted Bundys and the John Wayne Gacys, when I think the last vestiges of innocence in this country.
Yeah.
This was sort of the end of it.
Yeah. I was born in 67. So I grew up in the 70s and knew people that would hitchhike to the mall. And certainly I was a lot more aware of that and tried to, avoid that. I had a couple of strange run-ins growing up, but it went through, I think, till about 84, 85 before people really just locked down on it. And you just don't see it. Even on the highways during all of my travels, seeing hitchhikers is so rare. Maybe once every 10 trips do I actually see somebody out there hitchhiking. It's like a death of innocence. But think of how abundant that was for psychopaths, for people that had sexual deviance and murderous thoughts. It was a picking ground, and it wasn't just women. There were men that were out, and former vets that were out there, and people just trying to get from one place to another, trying to make their way and thinking, just hoping for the best of our neighbors. And how many of them were never heard of again? How many of them were found sadly like this in a canal or hidden in the woods in shallow graves? It's it's really a sad aspect of who we are and the culture we're in. And even though hitchhiking is no longer in effect, social media meetups, you know, even things like Craigslist murders and dating app murders have kind of taken that place. Where there is a will, there truly is a way. It's sad to say.
Right. Yeah. And this, I think what you said is absolutely correct. I just couldn't imagine, if there was a sexual deviant out there driving by in South Florida in 1975, and he sees two 14-year-old girls standing there with their thumbs out looking to pick up a ride to go somewhere. I mean, my God, can it get any more horrific to think of? If you're a parent, if you're law enforcement, and they told the public, do not hitchhike. And I have some discussions in the book that a lot of it was the vestiges of the 60s where, hey, if something happens, I can handle it. Everything's going to be okay. And a lot of girls found out the hard way that brutally murdered because of hitchhiking. But I don't think we can blame hitchhiking. That was just, like you said, it was just the means that some very evil people used. And the evil today uses different means to get these victims.
A lot of these killers also seem to out themselves in jail. Were there any people of interest that did lay claim to knowledge or being involved in any of these murders at the time?
You know, nobody.
Jailhouse confessions to their rooms.
Nobody that I'm aware of, in terms of confessions. I do devote a good amount of the book to a number of suspects. There are some people that I think should be looked at pretty carefully. There are some people that maybe kind of fell through the cracks, but nobody really confessed or implicated anyone else in these cases. But there were some people that were looked at by law enforcement as possibly being suspects, but nothing ever came of it.
Well, there was one case that was ever solved in all of this. And can you tell us again a little bit about that? And, do they have the wrong guy?
Well, that was actually the only case that was solved in the canal murders and flat tire murders was the case of Judith Oesterling, who was found beaten to death, drowned in a canal, basically thrown in to the canal while she was still alive. In October of 1975, police who were still working the case, 10 months later, were eventually able to obtain a confession from Sue Walter, who was known as Tiger Sue. She was the owner and operator of the massage parlor where Judith worked. And she confessed that she and her boyfriend had beaten Judith to death and thrown her into the canal, basically as a result of Judith refusing their sexual advances. She received a sentence of 15 years in prison. And her boyfriend, Clarence Carnevale, was already dead. He had been murdered in July of 1975, which kind of eliminates him as the possible suspect for some of the later murders. So there was one murder that was solved, and lo and behold, one of the killers was dead by the time the case was solved. And the other one confessed she was a heroin addict. It just reflects what a wild place South Florida was at the time. Massage parlors, hitchhiking, murders sort of left and right. Really just a strange and wild place.
Do you think that any of these were copycat murders? Once they start hearing about one murder and, oh man, that's an easy place to dump.
I think that's a possibility. Judith was found in the Snake Creek Canal next to US 27. And that canal later, a number of victims were found in that canal as well. So whether Sue Walter and Clarence Carnevale were involved in some of the other murders, we really don't know. I kind of doubt it. It seems like they were only involved in Judith's murder. But perhaps there was somebody that said, hey, this is a good place to put a body. It's remote. it's and I drove on that road a few months ago when I went back to South Florida. I drove on it for the first time, and it's like driving on the moon. There's sugarcane fields on either side and a canal, and basically that's about it. So if you want a remote place, that's where you're going to find it. So yeah, US 27 played a big role in these cases.
Heartbreaking story. Again, if you know anything about it, if you lived in that area at that time and you have any way to help, reach out to the author and get this information to him, Michael P. Burns. Again, the book is called The Flat Tire Murders, Unsolved Crimes of a South Florida Serial Killer. We do have a link for that in today's program guide. Make sure that you check that out, rate and review the book as well. Michael, thank you so much for coming on and sharing this with us.
Thank you very much, Dave. It's a pleasure.
Well, that's it, folks, for our interview portion. I hope you enjoyed today's show. For the rest of you, stay tuned. It's time now to kick open those case files of dumb crimes and stupid criminals.
It's Crayon News story time.
What happened with this dude, Christ Bearer? I heard he cut his penis off and then jumped off a balcony.
Suspect pulls gun from butt, shoots twice at Denver police.
What is your emergency?
Hello, I need help.
And what's the problem?
I'm too high.
You're too high?
Yeah.
All right, Tim, before we dive into the world of dumb crimes, stupid criminals, something pretty horrific in the news over the last few days. Astro World, the tragedy that took place.
Yeah.
In Houston, there is an interesting story TMZ had published. The Houston Police Department's chief, Troy Finner, rather, confirmed what TMZ had been hearing, namely that at least one person had been injected with something via needles.
Yeah.
And there may well have been more. Chief Finner said a security guard working the event felt a prick in his neck by an unknown assailant while he was trying to restrain a citizen, and he quickly fell unconscious. Finner says the guard was revived by using Narcan, and that medical personnel did indeed see something on his neck that indicated he'd been stabbed with a syringe. Finner also said some people had been trampled. So it appears there was a mix of reasons why people were injured and passing out, and perhaps why some died. The total number of people who had passed away at the time of this article remains at 8, and autopsies are underway to determine what the causes of death were for each one. The mayor, Sylvester Turner, said something like this has never happened in Houston, and they will leave no stone unturned to get to the bottom of how and why this occurred. Live Nation and Travis Scott's camp are cooperating with authorities, and the investigation continues. Houston PD called on the public's help for those with legitimate information. One last thing, Houston authorities insist the concert was shut down in a timely manner, saying the first reports of people going down started around 9:30 and that they closed up shop at around 10:10 p.m., which they feel was efficient considering the circumstances. Just a horrific set of circumstances. I was reading online one person's account of how he was part of this crush, this swell that took place during this concert, and was watching people disappear into this, as he said, black hole of humanity, being crushed, stamped, trampled. And he had actually accessed part of the stage at one point, begging for help, and security threatened to throw him off a 15-foot stage.
Oh.
Or he could go down himself. And he said, just look. And he was begging the cameraman, look at the crowd. You can see this happening. Nobody did a thing. At least that was the claim of this one eyewitness. So it's tragic. It's terrifying. And so sad. And then to think that on top of it, you've got somebody that may be walking around at an overstuffed concert with syringes and just dosing people without their knowledge.
That's kind of a worst nightmare scenario. It really is. Ugh,
I mean, terrifying.
When you think about how vulnerable you are, when first of all, if you have, like, I'm extremely claustrophobic, so I get real bad anxiety when I'm in crowds like that.
Mm-hmm.
That's like a worst nightmare scenario for me. It would be to be, and I hate, one of the things I hate in concert seating scenarios is when you have main floor and it's general admission. So
yeah,
if Astro World was anything like that, where everybody was kind of stuffed up against that barrier, and it was just general admission on the floor where you just basically all, you know, are packed like sardines up to the barrier of the stage. That to me is like a worst case scenario, because at that point you can't move. Everybody's just pushing to get up to the stage and there's no space. You can't move anywhere. And then at that point you're completely vulnerable. And I can't imagine this, because, you know, being a bigger guy myself, at least I can use my strength to try and move around or get some space or do whatever. But at that point, your animal instinct kicks in. So at that point, you're like, just if I got to get out, at least I can push my way out or try to push my way out. For someone who's smaller, who doesn't have that advantage, I got to think that that is just the ultimate feeling of hopelessness. It's a nightmare scenario. It's, you know, I mean, it's a life or death type of thing. I mean, I realize that carnival type seating is what they call it. It's less and less in most states, although they still do it in some states and in some type of music, concerts
and venues.
I wish they wouldn't. I really wish they wouldn't. I understand that there's some music formats that it's advantageous for. But it really is just,
you know, it's getting bad when people are afraid to go to movie theaters now, because you don't know if some lunatic behind you is going to shoot. You don't know what's going to happen. Now you have to start worrying about concerts. I love live music and live concerts. Yeah. You and I both have attended hundreds in our lifetime. And to think that this could be going on and there's, you know, oh God, that there's just these different options. And, you know, the real problem is people just have to stop being assholes to one another.
Yeah.
When Nathan, my son, turned 18, like 3 days later, there was a Billy Idol concert at First Avenue. Mm-hmm. And it was an 18 plus show. So I was going to get to take him to his first 18 plus show at First Avenue to see Billy Idol. How cool is that? And we were there, and, you know, Nathan's a big kid. He's like 6'5", right? Mm-hmm. Huge kid, well built. He works out, takes care of himself, just the consummate jock. And while we're there, there were these women in front of us that were all maybe between 5 feet to 5 feet four tops. And we were very close to the stage. I would say we were within, you know, if there were, you know, if you're counting rows, we were probably a third, fourth row back. And then these women in front of us. And we were there when the doors opened, and, you know, it was like an hour, 20 minutes before the show even started. And just 10, 15 minutes before showtime, this group of guys just comes crushing their way up to the front and just get right in front of these women. And they're all big guys, you know, 6 feet and above. Mm-hmm. And they just kind of stomp in front of these women, and these women just had this shocked look. And Nathan reaches forward and taps on the one guy's shoulder, and he goes, hey, man, we've been here the whole time. And the guy goes, that's your fucking problem. And Nathan just looks at me, puts his arm down like an arm at a parking ramp.
Yep.
Right? In between these guys, and shoves with one arm, just moves these guys out of the way. And the women below him are just like, what just happened? Right. Mm-hmm. And I thought, oh shit, it's his first 18 plus concert, and we're going to have a father son fight with these idiots. Right. Mm-hmm. And he goes, no. And the one guy starts to talk, and Nathan just goes, no. And that was the end of it. But again, what makes you think that you're so fucking important?
Yeah.
That you can just do this. You can crush people. You can, you know, it's ridiculous. I went to see Springsteen in 1985 at Soldier Field. I think there was like 100,000 people there. And we were passing my buddy's father's like $300 pair of field glasses up and down the field, and they would come back to us. Mm-hmm. People were kind. They were respectful. We made our way through to get by the closer to the stage. People would politely let you get up there, and then we'd turn back around after we get to see a few songs up close and go back to the middle of the crowd. And you know, I mean, there's always been tragedies. There's been tragedies at Who concerts and Rolling Stones concerts and, you know, bad drugs being passed around at Woodstock or not Woodstock. Well, yeah, I think it was Woodstock. But there's always been some issues and there's been some tragic deaths in these situations. But at what point do you just realize nothing is worth pushing, crushing, shoving to get an extra 6 inches closer to that celebrity so you can be a little bit tighter? You know what? We'd all like to be able to see what we go to see and have unimpeded vision. But at what cost? You know, going to sports events, I've had guys stand up in our home stadium and blast us because we're cheering on our team and they just absolutely bitch slapped the opposing team and the guy in front of me didn't like that I was cheering him on. You're at a football game, you're at a baseball game, basketball, hockey game. You have to realize it's them against us on the ice. We're all there because we're passionate about the sport. And I've said on two or three occasions, yeah, I'm not going to get in a fist fight with you. This is a sport.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
You know, and it's just like, don't be such an idiot. You know, if you're that person, fucking stay home. Mm-hmm. That's all I got to say about it. And going to these places, be aware now, folks. Get off your fucking phones. Pay attention to your surroundings. Be in the moment. Be aware because things are getting scary out there.
Yeah.
And when we're now seeing concerts, this just gave a whole bunch of other idiots some really bad ideas.
True, very true. And not like there weren't plenty of bad ideas already out there. But yeah, you know, I think part of it is as much as I hate to put it this way, you know, the venues are getting bigger and bigger for stadiums and the prices are going up and up to see musicians. And with that, I think people are feeling more and more entitled because you're paying more to see musicians. So they're feeling like if I'm going to pay this much money to go see a musician, I get to do whatever I want in that amount of time that I'm there. If I'm sitting this far away from that musician, well, if there's an open seat 20 rows up, well, I'm going to go take it. You know, if I'm going to show up pissed drunk and cause a ruckus, well, then that's what I'm going to do. You know, if I'm going to infringe on somebody else's freedoms or whatever, or if I'm going to cause somebody to have a bad time because I want to have a good time, well, then that's what I'm going to do. You know, because I paid so much money to come here and have a good time, then I'm going to do whatever I want to do to have a good time. Even if that makes somebody else have a terrible time or even put somebody in a hospital. You know, that's where tragic. We're at. Yeah. That's where we're at.
It's a self-entitled, self-gratuitous world. And yeah. I hope people just start taking more stock of that.
Yeah.
And the one thing, folks, you've got to stop your friends from doing karaoke that can't sing. There's yes. the true dumb
yeah,
crime.
That is.
And,
yeah.
You know, I know we all have a song in our soul, but that's why we have cars and bathrooms. And,
yeah. That's and why you have a shower for that. Yeah.
That's when you shine, man. That's mm-hmm. when you sing along. When I'm at a concert and I've got a guy behind me singing along in full scale with no ability to hold a note, I'm not even sure that what he's doing is actually considered singing. It makes the concert tough. But again, I understand you paid to be there. You want to have that good time. I've tried to become cognizant of that because I love to sing along and I realize I am not the greatest singer in the world. I'm third or fourth behind Don Johnson. You know, so I realized nobody came to this concert to hear me sing these songs. But you know, there's those moments when you all sing along. It's just, you know, we have to watch each other's back, be each other's brother's keeper, not only on the dance floor, but also at the karaoke bar. Just if people can't sing, let them know.
I'm tolerable of bad singing. You know what I have a problem with, and I had this problem when I went to see the Stones. I had a guy in front of me who, because I don't know if you know this or not, Dave, but Rolling Stones tickets are now in upwards of $500 a piece.
Yeah, yeah.
They're pretty darn expensive. I had a guy in front of me. The row in front of me had about 7 or 8 empty seats. And I had a guy who had probably had about 14 or 15 more pops than he should have had before he sat down. And and he decided he was going to take and dance up and down this entire aisle drunkenly, but do it like an angry rabid monkey that had a little bit too much testosterone in his lower regions and had no rhythm whatsoever as he was doing it, but then decided to do it right in front of me. Now, I was sitting for most of the time because of some pain issues. And so he wasn't getting the point that he shouldn't be doing this. He was also hitting the people in front of him. And there was a gentleman in front of him who had some pain issues, and he was hitting him with his knees. And so this guy turned around halfway through the concert and said, "Hit me with your knees one more time, and I'm going to knock you on your ass." And he just,
I've been at a few concerts where all of a sudden a guy just turns around and punches somebody and drops them because they were doing that same thing.
Yeah.
Just swinging their arms, bopping, hitting, you know, and I'm all for dancing. When you go to a concert, I understand you want to get, you feel that music, but you know, stay in your little cubicle.
Right. Exactly. You know? You paid for a seat. You paid for a space. Go nuts in your space. I don't care.
Yeah.
You know, have
unless,
a great
of course,
time.
You're at like the Black Flag, Meat Puppets, Suicidal Tendencies concert, then beat the shit out of each other in the mosh pit. But
right.
Keep it to the mosh pit.
Yeah, keep it to the mosh pit.
We're the old guys, Tim.
Yeah.
You kids in your rock and roll music.
Hey, I've been in plenty of mosh pits in my day, and I did some damage. I had a lot of fun.
I remember watching. Yeah.
And I'm hurting for it. But you know what? It's. You know, have your good time, but just don't keep running in front of me. That's the thing. Yeah, or even standing directly in front of me when you see him holding a pair of crutches. Because otherwise, I'm going to flash back to Blaine Bengals baseball, and I'm going to take your hat off with one of them. So this guy keeps going back and forth in front of me, and I'm thinking, now, do I want to take his head off and miss the rest of the concert, or do I just want to tap him on the shoulder with one of them? So I'm sitting there and I'm going, and so I start going Zen and I start breathing deeply and I go, you know what? I'm just going to tap him on the shoulder with one of them. So the guy's going back and forth. He's like, yeah. And he's humping the air like a rabid monkey. And I go, finally, I just like 2/3 of the way through the concert, I tap him on the shoulder. And he goes, and he starts looking around like he's been, you know,
tapped by a ghost?
Yeah. Yep. And he turns around and goes, oh, sorry. And then he like, you know, drunkenly dances back towards his seat and falls into his chair. I kid you not. I got the biggest laugh out of it. And then he kind of sat there for a minute because the world was spinning. And then he got back up and went to go dance like a horny monkey again. And then he was pumping his fist in the air and started hitting the guy in the back again with his knees. And the guy's son got up and he turned around and looked at the guy and he got nose to nose with him. And he goes, are you ready to go down a flight of stairs? They went, oh, I got more fun just watching this guy get talked to by different people during the concert than anything else. But yeah, you know what? It probably save the party for after the concert. Just have fun watching the main event.
My other favorite moment in a concert-like environment was, I think we were at Mystic Lake. Bill Cosby was performing. And this was back in the day before we realized what he was doing. And Warren Moon was our quarterback at that time.
Oh, yes, yeah.
And he and a couple of the football players sat in the row in front of me. And they had their wives with them. Mm-hmm. And Warren's smooching up on this woman. And the guy over to my right goes, dude, it's Warren Moon and his wife. And the guy goes, dude, that's not Warren Moon's wife. And Warren Moon stops and just slowly turns and looks back at him. And we got all real uncomfortable real quick. It was one of those moments. Oh, well, you know, maybe keep that up in the private box, Warren. That's all we're going to say.
Yeah.
We're going to Bloomington, Illinois for our first Dumb Crime, Stupid Criminal, Tim, where you and I apparently should go trick or treat next year. Bloomington police are looking for a trick or treater who lost some of his high value goods over the holiday weekend. A Facebook post from the department Monday told the tale of someone who lost a bucket full of weed.
Oh.
Police confiscated the bucket containing 383 grams. Of the green treat in a Southwest neighborhood Sunday morning. In tongue-in-cheek fashion, police are hoping the owner will message them so they can be reunited with their stash, which happens to be more than 10 times the legal amount to possess.
Oh, my.
Yeah. So some poor bastard put his weed in a pumpkin, Halloween pumpkin, and it got taken.
That's
a lot of weed.
That will have you seeing ghosts everywhere.
Sheesh. A Florida teacher named Teacher of the Year felt that a student's pushback on her award was a threat. Now she's arrested for child abuse after retaliating. That's right. Caroline Melanie Lee, a teacher at Darnell Cookman Middle High in Jacksonville, Florida, was recently tapped as Teacher of the Year. However, just as she settled into this new honor, she was arrested and charged with third-degree felony child abuse for allegedly striking a student at the school. Lee is accused of hitting a girl who has not been named in the face. So this is, again, poorly written. Lee is accused of hitting a girl who has not been named in the face.
Well, you know why? Because the parents were late with the birth certificate. That's why.
Oh, is that what it was?
Yeah.
It's not that the girl, you know, her face wasn't named.
Right.
They don't name for legal reasons.
And right.
She slapped that girl in the face, causing her nose to bleed. After the student reportedly questioned Lee's appropriateness for the honor on social media, a Duval School's police report obtained by News 4 Jax stated, in a single since deleted Instagram post, Duval County Public Schools shared Lee's photo. But instead of congratulatory remarks, some people in the comments section reportedly questioned whether the 60-year-old Lee was the same teacher who used the N-word and engaged in other microaggressions against students.
Oh, my.
Wow. Lee denied using the slur in an offensive manner, claiming that she was only saying it when she was reading the John Steinbeck controversial novel of Mice and Men in class. In addition, officers also stated that Lee acknowledged that it was her word against the girls, but still maintained she did not cause physical harm to the girl, according to the outlet. Authorities said Lee claimed she thought the message on Instagram was a threat to kill her. She noted that she was not afraid and did not feel the need to report the message to staff. Well, then why'd you hit her? If you feel like she was going to kill you, I would have reported that right away.
Mm-hmm.
On Friday, October 29th, police said Lee went to the first period class of the student and asked that teacher if she could speak to the student privately. The teacher later told the student, who does not have any classes with Lee, of this request, but the girl did not comply. The police report says Lee later returned to the same class and got the girl to leave with her. School surveillance video shows Lee walking at an aggressive pace to her classroom with the student following prior to the incident. A boy at the door to Lee's class was told to leave, and Lee and the girl went inside and closed the doors. Once they were inside talking about the post, that's when Lee reached across the table and struck the girl several times, causing her nose to bleed. That's what the student told officials.
Jeez.
Now, a few minutes later, the student was seen leaving the classroom, holding her face and walking with a low demeanor to a guidance counselor's office where she reported the incident. The who had been at the door, I didn't know that Roger Daltrey and Pete Townsend were hanging out at the door of this middle school, but the who had been at the door confirmed that all, I think that meant the student who had been at the door confirmed that all but a calm conversation took place in Lee's classroom, telling authorities he heard shouting coming from inside. Oh, good God. Her court date is set for November 22nd. Don't take the law into your own hands. Dun-dun-dun. Take him to court. The people's court.
So Roger Daltrey's standing in the doorway going, see me.
That's right.
Feel me. That's
slap me.
Slap me. Punch me. So Sweet Caroline is taking it out on the kid. Not having a good time there, huh?
Teacher of the Year award's probably going to be stripped. Who knows?
Yeah, I think so.
Who knows? Mm. Where do you want it? That's what the wife allegedly asked her husband before shooting him.
Wow.
Not in the face. Isn't that what Pussy said on The Sopranos?
Please, Tony, not in the face, huh? Yeah. Do me a favor, Texas, not in the face.
A Texas woman is accused of shooting her husband during an argument after he returned home late from a bar. San Antonio police told media outlets officers arrived at the home in Donnelly Place on the northeast side of the city early in the morning of Tuesday, November 2nd. WOAI, the way, reported Tim. The husband was taken to a hospital and the wife arrested, according to the TV station. Investigators say the couple had been arguing off and on all day. At some point, the husband left, went to the bar, came back after midnight when the arguing commenced. Police told KSAT, during the argument, KENS reported, man, they're all over. KENS, KSAT, and KOA. The woman pulled out a gun and asked her husband, where do you want it? She's then accused of shooting him in the leg. The husband is in stable condition, outlets reported, and the wife is facing charges of aggravated assault.
You know what I would have told her?
Wow.
I want it right in the mother-in-law.
That's horrible. I do not condone mother-in-law abuse. All right. More trouble for Florida man poster boy, Tim.
Oh, no.
The Florida man who has a silhouette of the Sunshine State tattooed on his forehead is facing a felony charge for allegedly throttling his mom inside the travel trailer where he resides. Is it really a travel trailer if it's on concrete blocks? Investigators allege it Matthew Lethem, 23, wrapped his arm around his mother's neck, constricting her airflow to the point she faded out. Lethem, who is free on $10,000 bond, choked out his mom. He's out on 10 grand. Is scheduled for a November 17th pretrial hearing in connection with a criminal information charging him with domestic battery by strangulation. A felony carrying a maximum. How long do you think it is, Tim? Trying to choke your mom out. How, as an adult, 23-year-old man choking his mom out.
Oh,
what is the maximum felony?
I was going to say in a wrestling ring, it's a five count, but
right.
In Florida, mm-hmm. Well, in Florida, it's a holiday, I believe, in April. We'll go, because it's only mom, we'll go $2,000.
No. How long of a, what I'm asking is how long is the sentence do you think he'd get if he's found guilty?
Is it actually
a felony carrying
it's an actual
battery by strangulation.
Oh, it's an actual felony in Florida?
Uh-huh.
Oh, I thought as it was
it a... Folks, understand he's doing this tongue-in-cheek, so don't send us emails. Yeah. He does not condone beating or choking out your mom or anybody else's
I'm just saying
that.
It's Florida. I mean, you know.
Right.
Okay, so felony. We'll go 2 years.
2 years for choking out your mom, almost killing
it's
her?
It's Florida!
My God, it was a five count as well. 5 year prison sentence if he's found guilty.
All right.
5 years for choking out your mom. How do you, could have killed her if you crushed that carotid artery?
It's Florida.
As detailed in a complaint affidavit, the 39-year-old victim was recently attacked inside Lethem's residence at the Lakewood Travel Park in Hudson, a city about 45 miles north of Tampa. The woman told police she had gone to her son's home to pick him up and drive him to work. Upon arriving at the trailer around 2:40, the victim said her son was intoxicated and laying down on his bed. When she woke him, Lethem stated, "I can't do this anymore. I'm just going to kill you," cops charge. Lethem then allegedly threw a large television at his mother, who attempted to flee from the small quarters, all because she came to give him a ride to work. Lethem, the affidavit states, grabbed his mother around the neck in a headlock and began to choke her out. The victim told police she felt that like it was... Police? The victim, let me try this again, Tim. Words is hard. The victim told police she felt like that was it, and she faded out. The woman added that she made it to the trailer's doorway and kicked the door open and called for the neighbors to dial 911. So if he says, "I'm going to kill you," and chokes you to the point you hit the ground, to me, that's attempted murder. I would become Dave Schrader prosecuting attorney at this point, Tim, and turn my head around.
I think you got an easy defense here, Your Honor. Yeah. My client's been watching too much WWE because a headlock and then a chokehold. I mean, come on. That's straight out of...
Yeah, using the TV. I mean, if there would have been a steel chair in there, you know, that would have been his first choice.
That's right. Yeah.
Lethem works as a cook, first appeared in our show back in February, I think it was, for his arrest for misuse of 911 system and marijuana possession. Charges for which he later pleaded no contest and was ordered to pay about $500 in fines and court costs. So he's back. He's back at it in his choking mom ways. All right. This is the part of the show, folks, where you might want to just tell the kids to go watch TV or play on their Kindles, their tablets, whatever, put on your headphones. This is where we start getting into the more racy aspects of our show. A Rhode Island man is making headlines this week after he confronted someone stealing a part on his car, as he was, in fact, playing Grand Theft Auto at the time. It's life imitating art, imitating life. Charles Kendrick of Pawtucket, Rhode Island, was playing GTA naked at about 2 a.m. this week when he heard a sound outside his home. He stopped playing to go outside and have a look around, And that's when the drama ensued. I'm naked in my house. I'm relaxing, he told local news affiliate CBS 21. I come out of the house naked, and sure enough, there's somebody under my car. Kendrick confronted the man, who began swinging his reciprocating saw at him. A fight ensued. I started fighting with the guy, wrestling with him. He ends up elbowing me, but I still grab onto him, and I end up getting up his phone. I don't know what that means. This would-be thief was attempting to make off with the catalytic converter on Kendrick's car because of the valuable metals inside. This car part is commonly sought by thieves. I don't think he was expecting to get caught, and I don't think he was expecting to get caught by someone naked, Kendrick said. I guarantee I wasn't the first one out that night, but I guarantee you I was the last. Kind of crazy. GTA is all about thieving and being weird. And this guy just, I don't know, Tim, if I think somebody's out there stealing something under my car, I'm going to put on pants of some sort.
At least.
Before I go confront.
Yeah.
Because if this guy's under your car working on it, he's got tools, I don't want to take a tool to the tool.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Or a tool somewhere else. Yeah.
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 An 81-year-old pharmacist in Pennsylvania has been arrested and charged with trading pain meds for sexual favors from customers.
I got plenty of those here at the crib.
Oh, so you're willing to trade out?
Sure, why not?
I'll be right over. The Delaware County District Attorney's Office wrote in a November 1st statement that Martin Bryan was arrested and charged with distributing drugs from his pharmacy in Media, Pennsylvania, in return for sex from addicted customers that had no prescriptions. Bryan was charged with multiple counts of possession with intent to deliver a controlled substance, distribution of a controlled substance to a drug-dependent person, the dispensing of a controlled substance in a manner inconsistent with the rules of medical profession, the criminal use of a communication facility, and sexual extortion, according to the district attorney's office. Jack Stolstemir, I don't know how to say it, Delaware County District Attorney, said he was giving out those drugs to people who did not need them, people who were addicted to them, just so he could get what he wanted from them, which turned out to be sexual gratification. I guess when you got a handful of, blue chews right there at your counter all the time, Tim.
Yeah.
You're 81. Life gets a little boring. How else are you going to stir up some action? Good God. As the cops identified the occupants, a woman came out of the back of the pharmacy. Seeing the officer, she went back inside. Bryan then came out of the store. The cops questioned the two and became suspicious when their statements contradicted each other. They then seized the woman's mobile phone, where they found messages sent by the pharmacist instructing her on how to reply to the police questions.
Whoops.
An investigation in the pharmacy was opened. An audit of its records determined that there were large and copious amounts of missing medications that had not been properly accounted for. The analysis found the pharmacy run by Bryan was the biggest purchaser in the zip code of highly addictive drugs such as oxycodone, Xanax, and a deadly substance, fentanyl, between 2016 and 2021. How does a guy go 5 years with that much going missing and nobody's thought about checking him out before?
Good question.
Yeah. The woman previously questioned later confessed to police she'd been exchanging favors in return for drugs from Bryan on a weekly basis. Police were then able to identify a second woman who told the officers the same story. The second woman told authorities she received oxycodone from the pharmacist in exchange for the SEX, Tim. She then resold it to buy heroin. Stolstemir said, "What's going on with fentanyl is destroying families all across Delaware County as we speak." Bryan was not in custody during the investigation, but handed himself into authorities on November 1st. His bail bond? $250,000. Thomas Hodnett, acting special agent in charge of the Drug Enforcement Administration's Philadelphia Field Division, called the allegations against Bryan repulsive. He said they demonstrate Brian's total disregard for his legal and ethical responsibilities as a pharmacist. Yeesh. But that's not all, Tim.
No.
Oh. Now you got to be afraid of going to concerts and getting poked and Walmart. In a plea deal, a Florida creep who was spotted ejaculating on the back of a woman shopping with her son in the toy aisle of a Walmart.
Ew.
To 15 months in state prison. During a circuit court hearing Wednesday, Elias Floor, age 21, pleaded no contest to a felony child abuse charge in connection with the vile act at a Walmart in Winter Haven. Flora was originally charged with lewd and lascivious behavior in the presence of a child under the age of 16. Flora copped to the lesser child abuse account as part of the plea agreement. Prosecutors dropped a misdemeanor battery account. Oh, God. Upon completion of his prison term, Flora, who was taken into custody following his plea, will be placed on probation for 3 years. He also was ordered to pay about $900 in fines and court costs, and he will have to undergo a psychosexual evaluation. He turned himself in, and instead of beating the wrapped him,
no,
he's facing it. According to Winter Haven Police Department report, Flora approached the victim from behind while she was shopping with her 12-year-old son. Flora unzipped his pants, pulled out his utensil, a police affidavit reported. Getting to within an arm's reach of the woman who was facing away from him shopping, and he released on the pants of the victim on her buttocks.
No.
That's this guy, no performance anxiety whatsoever.
Not at all. No.
Oh, this was happening while the woman's son attempted to alert the mother. The boy then explained what he had seen, prompting the victim to contact Walmart workers. After police released store surveillance photos of the suspect, Flora, who lives just a few miles from the Walmart, turned himself in and reportedly admitted to masturbating in front of a child while he was in the store. Ah. The battery count, cops noted, was filed since the victim did not give Flora permission to ejaculate on her. So had she been like, yeah, all right, fine, they wouldn't have pressed charges?
What is he like, run up like a clown throwing confetti and just, bah! And then if she would have went, okay, then it would have been all right.
The Rip Taylor of the sexually deviant world.
Yes.
Oh, splash. A dispute over a borrowed sex toy ended with a Kentucky woman stabbing her male cousin with a kitchen knife.
Wait,
according to cops who arrested the alleged assailant on multiple criminal charges.
Borrowed?
Police were dispatched late last month to a home in the city of Corbin after the occupant, Crystal Denham, called 911 to report she had been stabbed by a relative. Seen above in this photograph, the 33-year-old Denham told officers that Michael Barton had come to her residence and that they had gotten into an argument over a sex toy, according to court citations. Specifically, Denham added she had borrowed it and he wanted it back. Okay. Sadly, the sex toy in question is not further described in the citation, which identifies Barton as Benham's cousin and neighbor. Denham claimed that after she told Barton to get off her property, he grabbed her by the elbow. Denham said she then used the kitchen knife in her hand to stab him, but said she didn't think she even drew blood. Hey, you big ninny. Stop being such a bitch. Barton, cops report, suffered 3 minor cuts on his arm and back. He confirmed that the pair had gotten into an argument over the sex toy, adding that he went to leave when Denham begged or began acting crazy. Denham was charged with felony assault as well as menacing disorderly conduct and resisting arrest. She's locked up in the Whitley County Detention Center in advance of a December 20th appearance in district court. Here's just a quick rule of thumb. Just don't loan out your sex toys.
Yeah, well.
It's all, creepy, weird, disgusting, freaky. That's what you've been listening to. We are the best in true crime talk radio. That was Dumb Crime, Stupid Criminals. He's Tim. I'm Dave. And this is True Crime Tuesday.